So the subject of my talk this morning is the Rove Conservation Study of 1979. And this was a landmark study, and it's very rare that a piece of work like this would have its relevance for 35 years and more, but it does, and it's still talked about in the town today. And so I wanted to reflect on what happened with this study, what values that it represented, how it's thought about Rove and its community and its development in 1979, and the way in which people and the natural environment and the town could come together in a sustainable way. They actually used the word sustainable in those days, maybe for the first time. It's one of the very first usages of it in this sense. But really, it plays into some of the very big themes that we're all dealing with in the world at the moment, which is the intersection in one place of these big themes of sustainability and how to live together sustainably. This particular study was commissioned by the state and the council together, Department of Housing, Urban and Regional Affairs, which did a number of studies at that time, and the Department for the Environment and the District Council of Rove. The people who undertook it were the Urban and Environment Planning Group, and they were based in Hackney Road, but they did a lot of studies at that time, just a whole lot. They did the Nanham Waterfront Development Study in 1979, the Hallett Cove development hadn't happened then, they did that in 1980, and then moved on to a big study of the southeast coast protection, based, I think, largely on the work they did in Rove, but extending. They did a big study of the Lower Lakes and Lower Murray, looking at different operational studies of that, and Moonta town development. So they're a very flexible and really very well-regarded group because the state seemed to use them all the time for these big studies. But the council also was in there, and that's worth pointing out. I don't see any council people here. This is a good thing. I'll say some critical things about this. So the main aims of this study, and it's called a conservation study, but it wasn't really. It was a planning study with a conservation bent. So it really embraced the whole idea of what Rove was going to be going forward and how we should think about Rove. So the two aims were to identify the particular characteristics of Rove that were important, and they singled out, oddly, I think, geological, anthropological, and scenic value, which was a little odd in the frames of reference, I would have thought. You wouldn't have thought geology had come out in front, but anyway, it was there, and anthropology also, for reasons which I'll talk about. But then the bigger idea was to develop a conservation and development plan for managing future change and development in a way which would retain historic, again, geological and anthropological significance and balance that in a coherent way. They formed a steering committee in town. There were town meetings. There were various government departments involved. The biggest commercial enterprise at that time was SAFCOL, reasonably enough, as in the fishing industry, and they were involved. And there were many individuals who were part of this. So let me just see if I can make this work. I wanted to just talk a little bit about Australia in 1979. Looking around, a number of you may actually remember this. So here was the federal government at that time. We'd come out of the Whitlam era into the Fraser era. It was the end of the first Fraser government. And they had put in place those two sets of governments, many of the major parts of legislation, the really big blocks of legislation around the national parks particularly. So Uluru and Katajuta and Kakadu were done at the time. Kosciuszko was already there, had been done before then. Mungathiri, which is the Simpson Desert Park, was put in place at that time. And the big acts were there over that period of time. So the Environment Protection Act of 74, the National Parks and Wildlife Act of 75, the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park was established there in 75 and the Australian Heritage Commission also in 1975. So this was a huge time of putting in place the building blocks of conservation and heritage. At the state level, again, some of you remember these names and faces. So here's Don Dunstan with Gough Whitlam at the time and David Tonkin down the right-hand corner. And those governments, again, had made some major statements in South Australia. The National Trust had been devolved to the regions in 1968. Of course, it was founded a long time before then, in 1895. And at that point, in 1979, there were 24 items that were listed on the National Trust register, which was the most of any regional town. The Planning and Development Act and the Coast Protection Act. And I've got this picture in here of David Tonkin because these were the early days of the negotiations on the APY land, so which happened then in 1981. And then there was a lot of non-government action going on. Some of you will remember some of these names. So individual figures like Vincent Cervente and Warren Bennison, Harry Butler may ring a bell for some of you. The Great Barrier Reef campaign was the big campaign of the 1970s. And here's Judith Wright, who led that through the Australian Conservation Council. The Franklin River, here's Bob Brown looking young. Who was up in front at that time. And the Daintree was also coming onto the agenda. So again, the really big environmental campaigns were beginning to go on at that time. So this study was undertaken in two parts. First of all, there was a baseline study. So they went out and did the logical thing, and they gathered what's the current state of play. So they looked at these things, the historical context, the social and economic trends, the natural environment, the built environment, and interestingly, community perceptions and attitudes, which was very much not done at that time. It was very much planning and development and thinking about it at that time was technocratic. It wasn't really devolved to the community at all, but they made a point of doing that and beginning to think that way. And then what they called townscape, which was their word for the sort of integrated view of what it meant to live in a town. So the way all these elements came together and were combined was part of their baseline study. And then they did a set of policy guidelines. So they looked at legislation, they looked at broad objectives, and then they drilled down to specific objectives, this is what I want to focus on, the specific objectives and policies, and the policy area guidelines related to the places in Roe. So there were 14 zones that were set up within the Roe area, and all of them had specific guidelines based on it. So it was a very kind of logical structure. They started with big principles, and then they drilled down, and in fact, they talk about it that way, as being like a sieve, so that development proposals would be undertaken on the state, with respect to the state first, and then respect to these big guidelines, and then down to the specific guidelines that they were talking about. So let's have a look at some of the details of what they did. In their introduction, they actually covered some very interesting things. They talked, first of all, about the history of Roe and where it is now. Because what they were concerned to say is, where have we come from and where do we sit now? And I just had to use this photo, although I know it's a bit hard to see the print, but it's such a nice photo, which occurs, in the general things as well. They pointed out that the first 50 years, more or less, of Roe was a boom period based on Roe being a port. And a major port, a major regional point of entry, as we all know, right through to the whole of the southeast and through the Victorian border and beyond, and that's why we have a Chinese heritage. But that came to an end in 1876 when the railhead was established at Kingston. And at that point, Robe ceased to become a transport centre and became something else. And then it was really a fishing. Fishing became the major sort of rationale for Robe at that point. And the little economic development really occurred between that time, really for almost 100 years. And it was in the 1960s that they refer to as being a second boom period. And that was based on the post-war explosion into recreation and cars and people beginning to visit other places. So in the 1960s, there began to be the development of significant holiday houses down here. My wife's grandmother built one down here. When was that? 1961. And there was holiday house development, and then much of that, they're pointing out, wasn't in accord with the historical character of Roe, the heritage character of Roe. It was fairly random. And the influx of visitors in the summer began. That began to have an impact on the historical fabric in ways that weren't planned. So remember, this is 1979, so relatively within the last 10, 15 years, they'd been seeing that beginning to happen. They also looked at then the meaning of conservation itself, and here's where they began to define it in these broad terms. as including all the elements of the natural and built environment to achieve a higher sustainable quality of human life. And interestingly, and this is where it was very ahead of its time, the study, the best way, they said, to do this is not through planning and guidelines, but through the people who live here. And they make this point right through the study and conclude with it, that the best way to preserve the character of places is to encourage people to become more aware of the significance of what's there, of paying attention to it. Again, I think actually well ahead of its time. They looked at various other tools and various other approaches. And then in their baseline study itself, they began to collect all the information that they needed on to develop their guidelines. So, see if I can find this thing. And I won't go through this in detail because we don't really have time. But they looked at the history, and I just wanted to point out that they did mention Aboriginals in the Southeast. Now, remember, 1979. And in 1979, this was only 12 years after the referendum, which counted Aboriginal people for the first time. So this is early days. And in fact, it's quite remarkable that Aboriginal got a mention at all in this. They didn't in any other planning studies at the time, but they did here. Interestingly, though, they got a mention as having disappeared. And as we know from Irene Watson, that's very far from the case. Now, we know there's a very strong Bonobit group right through the southeast that has that long-standing relationship with the land, long-standing Aboriginal heritage, but they didn't find that. That's an interesting thing. It was there, but they didn't find it. Even though they went out and looked for it, it wasn't there. So they took a sort of standard view of the time, which was sort of assimilation / integration, and said, well, they were here, but they're not anymore. And there's, we can't think of anything to do about that. Then they looked in detail at the natural environment, and this again was a bit rare. This hadn't been done in the southeast. We'd built plenty of drains, but no one had actually sat down and said, well, what's actually here? Because the ecosystems, by and large, aren't spectacular, apart from the coast, inland, once you're looking at the freshwater resources and trees and vegetation, and it's not spectacular. But they actually took the time to evaluate them and to build them into their study. And then the built environment, of course, was right at the heart of what they were doing. They looked at all the historical fabric, and then they had these meetings with the community where they looked at all the different parts of, you know, community life. Did I set this up? Yes, like that. So here was the community, and they took time to find out what people wanted. And this was important because I'll tell you what happened afterwards. And then the townscape tried to bring it all together. So this was their study, and then they began to lay out the objectives. And they had two sets of objectives. One was the broad ones relating to planning and development of the large-scale development of the town and the community and the environment. So they started with looking at living and working and recreational activities within this environment, which was the right way in. They started with the people. Then they looked at scenic preservation and enhancement, which was a very strong theme of this particular study. They recognised that visual amenity was something very unique to Rowe and needed to be preserved in all sorts of different ways. And then, of course, at the buildings and the architectural and historical background. But then at the bottom, again, quite a unique feature at this time, land for public purposes. So they explicitly said there must be included in this plan the public stake, the stake of the community for areas which are its own. Some would argue, and I probably wouldn't disagree with them, that that hasn't progressed very far in the 35 years, but they put it on the agenda very strongly. And then they focused particularly on coastal zones. I just thought I'd put this photo up here because here's a car of the time right on the beach, and cars on the beach is still a major issue for us here and still a point of great debate. But they looked at this in a very, I think, advanced way, not just recreation and use, which is what we do now, the argument for cars on the beach as well. People like driving on the beach. It's recreational and a lot of people come and they bring money, cars on the beach. But they also looked at the visual amenity, natural process, and particularly the biological integrity of coastal waters. So they began to build in what was known, which wasn't very much, about the coastal ecosystem. that's still the case. We still know very little about the reef ecosystem, even 35 years later. They looked at beach and Fortean development, and here's mining and extraction. So they were very firm there should be no mining and extraction in this area. For those of you, us, who are concerned with sea wrack harvesting, well, here it was 35 years ago as regarding a substantial threat. And then they went into specific objectives, and that's what I thought I might have time here. 5 minutes? All right. Let me just cover these then. So their objectives were, they were principles which were then devolved into areas. So these were principles that were used to then identify what should happen at each of the specific areas of road. So there were 14 areas set up in this area here. So there was the local town, there was over the back of Smillie Street, there was a small areas. There's Lake Butler, there was Cape Dombey like that, and then right through to sort of Long Beach. So all of these had their own specific guidelines, but all driven by these broad-scale objectives, which came under the overarching objectives of what it meant to live in a place like Roe. So again, they run through these areas. So the town setting and the town character was by far the biggest recommendation, and they made very detailed recommendations building by building. This building, for instance, they pointed out was 1950s and ought to be knocked down or otherwise covered with trees, was their view in 1979. Screen planting was the idea. They were very terse about the council chambers, which they regarded as a blight on the landscape. They insisted that it should be views right through to the marina and out to sea, and that they shouldn't be blocked. I wonder why that happened. And so they were very specific about the design and the character and the integrated structure of what the town should look like, and that flowed then through into the way they dealt with, say, Long Beach and the other areas which were environmentally challenged, and then through into the other areas, recreation. Education was an interesting one there. Education, and this has come up many times, they pointed out that the town itself and its environment was extraordinarily rich and could be itself an educational environment if people understood it that way and came down here to learn. That's come up actually many times, but it's never really been put into operation. And then they did deal with economic development, but it was built at that time. It was still, the fishing was still very dominant in what was going on, but they saw that recreation was going to be increasingly important and the influx, and that would have to be planned for. So let me just, in these last couple of minutes, make a couple of general remarks about this. The thing about this study was that it was way ahead of its time. It was probably decades ahead of its time. And so the interesting thing is, well, what happened? Well, what happened was nothing. In fact, the community at that time, the regular community here that lived here, was strongly in favour of this study. And there was a petition gathered of over, and I've talked to some of the people who put that petition together, over 1,000 people signed it, which I'm sure would have been the entire population of Roe in those days, the fixed population. But the council didn't adopt it, and it never went ahead. And there are people here who were around at that time who can probably reflect on that. But to me, it's not unexpected. This was moving into the 80s. The 80s was the time where the free market came strongly to the fore, where economic development was seen as driving all other forms of development. And it's not surprising, in a sense, from a historical point of view, that that happened. But I still think, and this, the interesting thing about this study is it's still talked about in town. People still remember this study, and from time to time it's brought up whenever we have a new attempt at trying to decide what roads should be. People come back to this study. It picks up on a theme of sustainable development that had been running for 50 years in the United States, for instance, through Aldo Leopold's land ethic, where he talked about expanding the community to include the non-human community, the natural environment as well. Wendell Berry was writing just at this time in 1980 about the health of landscapes and the health of integrated places where people live together and the health of all the different elements of that. And Tim Winton, just to put a modern view in there, having just published his book called Island Home, which I'm sure some of you are reading, has made this point too. He said, I thought this very nicely, he said, activists didn't conjure collapsing fisheries, soil erosion, curdling wetlands and species extinctions. They didn't invent Australia's environmental challenges. They just noticed. They paid attention to their surroundings. They acted on evidence that everyone else around them was carefully failing to recognise. It's a very good summary, and I think that's what this study did. It paid attention. And of course, I just mentioned that the whole theme of sustainability after this became stronger and stronger right through the Millennium Development Goals of 2000. And you may not know that September of this year, the new set of Sustainable Development Goals was adopted, a set of 17 goals which are extraordinarily comprehensive and really have a great deal of support. But all of it is built on people, and I wanted just to end by reading to you the last paragraph of their study, of the main structure of their study. All of this that they'd set out in great detail, building by building, street by street, every part of Rove, all under this overarching framework, they said, this system will not work as truly intended unless there is a substantial reawakening of the community and the development of an appreciation of the special physical and cultural assets of Rove. If Rove is, this is a very strong statement for a group like this, if Rove is to be appreciated by persons other than architectural historians, the intertwined relationships between land and history, economy, society and culture must be acknowledged by the community so the integrity of the town and its environment is maintained by them and enhanced for future generations. So future generations came in here too, which is the sort of hallmark of sustainable thinking. So that was the vision towards which this, you would have to say, prescient study pointed in this one place. And I think it remains as persuasive and as urgent now as it ever was. Thank you.